Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind. Meditative stability.
Okay. Now, the next thing is, how do you cultivate meditative stability? And this is the next several pages, going through distraction and agitation and solitude, and there are three, as far as I can tell, three sections to this. One is avoiding distraction. The second is isolating the mind from discursive thoughts. I love this. This is just technically correct, but so misleading. And then through the isolation of mind and body, distraction will not arise. And then addressing the various reactive processes. And I think a good deal of translation needs to be done here. So let's start. This word avoid, I think, yeah, it's problematic. It isn't really avoid, it is stop. And there's a difference between avoiding and stopping. Avoiding has the idea that, you know, here's the distraction and you can go around it. But the distraction's still there, you just don't have to deal with it. This is a completely bad way of looking at this. Distraction is a process that that takes place in us. And by bringing attention to the process, we can become aware of, and this takes us back to the stuff we were talking about with karma, the genesis of distraction and the conditions in which distraction, or which foster distraction. So when we move down now to the next six topics, the primary characteristic of agitation, the cause of agitation, the faults of agitation, and the primary characteristic of solitude, the cause of solitude, and the good qualities of solitude. The primary characteristic is, what is it? The cause, I would prefer to translate, is the genesis of it. And then the faults are, why is it problematic? So, we got to translate this into just natural language. Okay, page 221 in Kenchok Jyotsen. The primary characteristic of agitation is to be scattered because of being in the midst of your children, spouse, retinue, and wealth. Now, this is being phrased this way because there's a heavy bias here towards living in isolation and solitude. But let's translate this into how it operates in our life. How many of you get agitated around your family? Okay. They push your buttons all over the place, right? That's why your mind's scattered there. Look at how people are with money. They just go berserk. So all of these things are things in our lives that generate reactive processes in us, and fragment attention. Okay? Now, the problem isn't our wife or husband or money or our career. The problem is the fragmentation of attention. And because we aren't leading monastic lives, we're not going to go off and live quiet lives in the backwoods of America or in monasteries and so forth, and just get away from all of that stuff in the hope that getting away from it allows everything to quiet down, which is essentially the approach for many monastics and hermits and so forth. Get away from the circumstances, everything quiets down, you got a chance to actually practice. Our focus has to be on how do we relate to our lives in a way that doesn't fragment attention. So it's a different emphasis, and I'm really interpreting this stuff in a different way for our lives here. And then the next paragraph is the cause of agitation. I want you to replace cause with genesis. The genesis of agitation, or this fragmentation, is because we have these connections. Emotional connections. But it's the nature of those connections that is the problem. They're based on reactive processes, not on necessarily the higher emotions or other things. That is, we're attached, when it says attachment to such things as meaning children, spouse, retinue, and so forth, we're trying to complete ourselves through these connections. That's what leads to the agitation. Because any time any of those, like take our spouse for instance, for many people, that connection, while it involves love, there's also an emotional need or a living through the other person in a certain way. They carry things for them. And so whenever they don't fulfill that, then all of the old pains are disturbed and become very agitated, and attention is fragmented all over the place. The same thing with money. I think it's actually easier to talk about it here, because what do we put onto money? There are two basic things that we put onto money. It's either our identity or our survival. And so when we see, in like we did several years ago, following 9/11 and the dot-com bubble bursting, our investments just nosediving, we feel our survival and our future is at stake, and kaboom, lots of reactivity, attention is fragmented. If we're working and we take a big hit in business, we get fired from our job, again, we think that our survival is at stake, and very often our identity. And it is those associations which cause attention to be fragmented, and we become very reactive and the mind is agitated. So, and the same with if you need recognition and you don't get recognition, then you get all churned up about that. Now, very broadly speaking, the monastic approach to this is to live in an environment where those factors, those conditions, are reduced to the minimum, in an effort to create an environment in which one's attention isn't being fragmented by that, and so you gain a little quiet and hopefully can build something. In our case, we have to work in a somewhat different way. And that is because we're right in the middle of it, and we're not withdrawing from it. We have to be clearer in our relationship with all of these things. That's how we reduce the tendency for attention to be fragmented. So with our spouse, it's not a case of trying to fulfill our emotional needs to that relationship, because it's whenever that's what produces the fragmentation of attention, but really just wanting to be with that person, which is qualitatively different, and a much clearer understanding of our relationship with money. Jacob Needleman, it must have been more than 10 years ago, wrote a book called Money and the Meaning of Life. And it's a good book. He's had a little too much wine to drink in the middle of it. But the beginning and beginning third and the last third are very, very good. And his basic thesis is that most people don't take their relationship with money. They don't take money seriously enough. And by that he means that we naively think that if we have enough money, then everything else in our life is going to be fine. And so we put all our eggs in the money basket. And of course, that makes us very vulnerable to fluctuations in our financial well-being. But also, it ignores the fact that many of the things that make life satisfying and bring peace, stability, and meaning to our lives actually don't depend on money. And there are other ways. And that if we took money more seriously, we would look very, very carefully at, does this actually produce the result that I want? And the answer to that frequently is no. And yet people don't really engage that examination. And so they think that if they had enough money, then everything would be fine. So they just put all their eggs in the money basket and make themselves very vulnerable to things that are totally outside their control. And little surprise that they're a little upset sometimes. Making yourself dependent on things that are outside your control, which is really what the false vegetation section here is about. You're never going to create the conditions within yourself for stability of attention to arise. And then on page 222, talks about the solitude. Now, the term here in Tibetan is empa. And it certainly has the meaning of solitude, has the meaning of isolation. Or solitude that comes from being isolated, separate. And as you see, the genesis of solitude, and again replace... well, let's go back to section 4 here on page 222. The primary characteristic of solitude, as Gampopa is presenting it here, is to be free from these agitations. Now, I've already described how we need to approach these things in our lives so that we're free from agitation. Here, literally, they said, you know, what is a monastery or what is a place of solitude? It's a couple of bow shots away from the marketplace. Well, here we are in L.A., good luck. So they call it an earshot, and there's somewhere else where it was a bow shot, and I think it was this, took your arrow, however far it would fall, and two of those was basically out of, and here it is, earshot. So you want to be away from the madding crowd, basically. In the conditions in which we live, this is completely impractical. We live in a city. There isn't any place that is out of earshot. So to the genesis for this kind of freedom from agitation, freedom from fragmentation, is a different relationship with what is arising in our experience. And what I've suggested is that we aren't looking for our emotional needs to be met in our relationships with others, in our intimate relationships. We aren't looking at money and career as... we need money in order to survive, but we aren't looking at it in terms of our identity and that placing, as I said before, everything in the money basket is going to take care of all of everything that we need. Being much clearer about what is important, truly important in our lives, what brings meaning, value, and peace to us. And that is rarely, maybe for some people, but for the most part, that actually isn't money or expensive things or what have you. It's quality of relationships. When we have relationships that are very good quality, they don't cause agitation. They don't cause a fragmenting of attention. It's the relationships which are more problematic that cause that. So we have to become clearer and clearer. That to me is how we have to approach the material that's being described here. And then the next section, it's an excellent offering to the Buddhas. One will renounce samsara, be free from the eight worldly concerns. Meditative stability will arise. I think that all follows very naturally from what I've been saying. When we talk about it's an excellent offering to the Buddhas, this isn't something we're doing for the Buddhas of the past, present, and future. That's a projection of Buddha as something outside us. Buddha is the awake quality of our own mind. So when we make an effort to clarify our relationships and with everything that we experience, to create the conditions to develop meditative stability, we are creating the conditions for that awake quality of our experience to actually manifest. So in that sense, it's an offering to the Buddha. It's an offering to the Buddha that we are, and actually nurturing or nourishing that. We become free from the worldly concerns. This is formal language for what I was just talking about. We've touched on this before. The eight worldly concerns are happiness and unhappiness, gain and loss, fame and obscurity, respect and disdain. Those become the aims of our lives and things we try to avoid, we've handed over our life to things that are outside our control. And from Buddha's point of view, that's not a real good thing to do. Okay. Then B, isolating the mind from discursive thoughts. Well, I think the first suggestion here is really important. What is your intention? Why are you doing this? The more clearly we understand our intention, the less fragmented our attention will be. So again, this idea of isolating the mind from discursive thoughts has this picture of the discursive thoughts are over there and we're going to isolate the mind from them. And I just think the image is wrong. Contrast that with when you are really clear about your intention, how distracted are you? No, you're not distracted. And it's in that sense that you're isolating mind from discursive thoughts. You're creating the conditions, actually, in which they don't arise, which is very different from walling them off. This. Linnea, can I have a mic for her? You should get that fourth mic out just for yourself.
When you say that when we're clear about our intention, we're free from distraction, we're not distracted, can you clarify if you mean that distraction, how do I put this? It's one thing to not be distracted and have clarity, but that doesn't necessarily mean comfort, does it?
You better give me an example.
If I'm clear that I have to act in a particular situation and I know what the action is, I know that I'm clear about it, I know what my intention is, and I know I'm going to go do this or engage in the situation, and there's a lot of emotion or difficulty in that, and in that process I'm going to have to experience that. That doesn't necessarily mean that if I am clear about my intention or not distracted, I'm not quite sure what that means,
okay,
that I'm pain-free or suffering-free.
I would suggest that it means you will be suffering-free. You may not be pain-free, because pain and suffering are not the same thing. Suffering is the reaction to sensations. So let's take a situation. You're a manager in a business. This is something I was being consulted about recently, that's why it comes to mind. A person that you hired is clearly not working out, and not only are they not working out, it's become clear that for whatever reason they don't have the capability to work out. So you've got to terminate them. So that's a painful situation. As long as you're trying to avoid that situation, your attention is going to be fragmented. When you see the situation for what it is, it's not good for him, it's not good for the company, it's not good for you, the whole thing. Then you realize, okay, this has to be done. When you see the situation as it actually is, my experience is that mind and body both relax. And now you can... So now attention is no longer fragmented. Will there be pain in the situation? Absolutely. Very definitely. That's not going to be a fun conversation. You're going to experience the pain of disappointing this person, as they express that, whatever their response to it is. There'll be pain in that. You know that you are creating difficulties for somebody in their life. You may be you're presenting them a situation where they thought they were doing fine, but that's not the case, and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of pain in that. That's unavoidable. What creates the suffering is if you try to avoid all of that pain. But when you really see the situation as it is, mind and body relax. You do what is necessary with unfragmented attention and experience what is there because you are clear about your intention. You know, there isn't an intention to do harm or hurt the person. It's addressing the situation and doing what you can for everybody that's involved. Because to do anything else is probably going to be even more problematic further down the line. Now, that's just one example, but one can think of similar situations in family life where a child, you need to talk to a child and disillusion the child that that life is going to be a certain way. That is painful for parents, but the unwillingness of some parents to experience that pain allows the creates the conditions in which the child actually never learns what they need to learn, and creates far more problems for both the child and the parent further down the line. And then there are other situations we can be with a friend, and our friend does something which really offends us. Maybe it isn't to us personally, maybe it's something that they say. And we realize that if we want to continue this friendship, we actually have to take this up with a friend. That can be painful. But when we are very clear about the situation and clear about our intention, and we aren't doing this to hurt our friend, we're actually doing it to salvage the relationship. So it's coming out of our affection and our appreciation of our friend, not out of our anger at them. Then we can engage these situations without the reactive emotions because we are clear about our intention. Does that clarify things?
Yes, it does. Okay. Thank you.
Right. Randy?
There can be a clarity of attention and low distraction and an absence of discursive thinking is something that I see around every day and disturbs me a lot because I think it's quite unhealthy. What if the intention is unwholesome? And I'm thinking actually of things like television and video games, an intention to escape from oneself. There's you watch somebody watching television and they're very focused. There's no distraction there.
I would differ. I would say it is distraction.
But it's a single-mindedness, I guess. Maybe that's
yes, it is a single-mindedness and it's a single-mindedness of not engaging other things.
Right, that's what I mean about unwholesome intention, of an avoidance or an escape intention as opposed to an intention to engage.
Yes, and it is very much about avoidance. It's in terms of reactive emotions, it is ignoring. It's the animal realm, and it creates suffering, definitely. Lanier? Chuck, you got one? Good.
I just wonder about that because I feel that, for instance, a form of entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
I hear this and it goes to a place of music and dancing are distractions and forms of escape. I could use
some clarity.
No, I
don't think that Randy was going there. It's one thing to sit down and watch a television show that you enjoy or go to a theater or something like that. It's another thing to sit down in front of the television and watch whatever's on because you don't want to face your life.
Zoning.
Yeah. Two very different situations, I would say. Okay. All right. It's 9:30 already and we're about halfway through the chapter. As you can see, this is a fairly meaty chapter and requires some translation and interpretation. What I'd like you to do over the next week is just what we've talked about this evening. Uh, I'm not sure how to put this in the form of a succinct exercise. But let's do it this way. I want you to compare your experience when you are clear about your intention versus when you aren't clear about your intention. It doesn't have to be just meditation. It can be anything. When you know why you're doing something, what is your experience of doing that thing versus when you aren't sure why you're doing something, what is your experience of doing that activity? Okay? I mean, this is pretty obvious in one way, but I want you to bring attention to it, because in the lives that we lead here in Los Angeles and in an urban environment, getting away from distractions is just not practical. Physically removing ourselves or setting up our life so it doesn't happen. We have to work more internally. And the way that I've come to see that is fruitful in this environment is to be really clear about intention. I want you to explore that experience. Let me know how it is. Okay?
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.